This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, in the spirit of Black History Month, we take a look at the epidemic of police violence on people of color.
We speak with attorney Carl Douglas, one of the great police litigators who has a law firm out in Los Angeles. We'll also speak with New York City attorney Deborah Beck. She's one of Julian Assange's attorney, and she's suing the CIA for spying on her.
And her lawsuit helps us remember that the case of Julian Assange is one of the most important challenges to freedom of the press in the history of our country.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm Jim Lafferty, a decades-long political activist and once the national director of the National Lawyers Guild. February is Black History Month in America, and on the very first day of Black History Month this year, Tyre Nichols, a young black man, was laid to rest in Memphis, Tennessee, having been murdered by police officers of the Memphis Police Department as he simply tried to get home. I find it almost impossible to keep up with all of the hundreds of cases of racist police violence against innocent black and brown men and women in America. At the moment, our nation is transfixed and in a state of great anger and anguish over the brutal murder of Tyre Nichols in Memphis. And the killings keep coming. In my city, Los Angeles, we're outraged by the police murder of Keenan Anderson, the cousin of Black Lives Matter co-founder Patrice Cullors. Both murders were filmed, and so once again the American people saw with their own eyes just how violent and despicable the police can be, and how indifferent the offending police officers are to the fact that what they are doing is being captured on film for all the world to see. Now, the overwhelming percentage of victims of police assaults are people of color, who've been murdered or otherwise brutalized by white cops. But as the Nichols case demonstrates, police violence is so ingrained in policing in America that black cops, too, often do not hesitate to employ gross violence in the course of their policing. Well, what accounts for this epidemic of cop killings of people of color in America? Is it connected to America's history of black enslavement? And is requiring the police to film while making arrests a good idea, since it certainly hasn't ended police violence? If not, what will it take to finally end this epidemic of racist policing? Well, to help us answer these and other questions about policing in America, we're fortunate to have as our guest today attorney Carl Douglas. Mr. Douglas is a partner in the law firm Douglas Hicks, one of Keenan Anderson's family attorneys, who've just filed a $50 million claim against the city of Los Angeles for what the LAP did in the Keenan Anderson case. Attorney Douglas, after working 6 years as a public defender, then spent 12 years in the Los Angeles law firm of famed and now deceased anti-police abuse attorney Johnny Cochran. And now his own law firm, the Douglas Hicks Law Firm, specializes in police misconduct and other civil rights cases, criminal defense work, as well as personal injury and employment discrimination work. In short, Mr. Douglas is a true lawyer for the people. Indeed, I have personally admired Mr. Douglas for years now. So, Carl Douglas, a very warm welcome to Law and Disorder.
Jim, thank you so much for having me on.
All right. Carl, while the Tyre Nichols case in Tennessee was on our TV screens constantly since he was brutally murdered by the Memphis police, our listeners would be, I think, less familiar with a local case in L.A., a case you're very much involved in, the case of the killing of Keenan Anderson in Los Angeles. So who was Keenan Anderson, and what happened to Mr. Anderson at the hands of the LAPD?
Jim, Keenan Anderson was a 31-year-old father of a 5-year-old boy who was an English teacher in Washington, D.C., from the Los Angeles area. In January of this year, he was involved in a minor traffic collision in the Venice section of Los Angeles near Venice Boulevard and Lincoln on the west side of L.A. He flagged down an LAPD motor officer there, and as you can tell through that motor officer's body-worn camera video, it appeared that something was wrong with Keenan. He did not appear to be in his right mind. He was talking in non sequiturs. He sounded paranoid, and the investigating officer was calling for backup to conduct a DUI investigation into this collision that was involved. As officers approached 7 minutes later, that first officer spent 7 minutes talking with Keenan, and it was clear that Keenan was not in his right mind, whether it was because of some mental health crises, whether it was because of drugs or alcohol, that was uncertain. But Keenan was compliant, he was always respectful, and he never presented a threat to anyone. As officers began approaching from a distance, Keenan saw them, and because he was not in his right mind, he then started moving away. In fact, he retreated to the center of Lincoln Boulevard, where he lay down in the streets and became very compliant and saying, "Sir." At that moment, the initial officer moved into what I say is a warrior mentality, giving strong orders. "Move over! Roll over! Show me your hand! Like cops often do. The other officers who came onto the scene were unaware that the first officer had spent 7 minutes with Keenan. They were unaware that Keenan was in some sort of a mental distress. They were unaware that Keenan had not presented a physical threat to anyone. All they knew was one of their fellow officers was giving commands to this man, and he was not complying. They then go into their warrior mode, and the three of these officers were unable to handcuff this unarmed, compliant man without one officer then having to taser Mr. Anderson six separate times. Four of the times, the taser was directly applied to his back, right in back of his heart. Each taser charge delivers 50,000 watts of electrical current into the subject. The LAPD's own policies speak against the wisdom of multiple taser charges being applied consecutively. So, is it really any wonder that sometime shortly thereafter, Mr. Anderson's heart begins to flutter, and hours later, he's pronounced dead at St. John's Hospital?
Yeah, that's really quite a story. Attorney Carl Douglas, I've seen at least some of the video of the police assaulting Mr. Anderson, and frankly, it seems clear to me that the repetitive tasering of Mr. Anderson when he was clearly neither resisting or in any other way threatening the well-being of the cops was simply unnecessary and emblematic of the LAPD police officers and those of other police departments employing unnecessary violence on those they arrest. Your thoughts on that, please.
Well, Mike, I have a fundamental thought that it's a matter of culture, and if you send a hammer into the garden, you cannot be surprised when the hammer treats all the flowers like they are nails. That's what happened here. It was clear that Mr. Anderson was in some sort of a mental distress. Officers routinely encounter citizens on what is often the worst days of their life. In Los Angeles, Mike, 60% of the county jail is housed with inmates that have diagnosable mental illness. But we continue sending these hammers into the garden. What we need to do, I say, is to change the culture of policing so that it is more of a guardian mentality than a warrior mentality. It is that warrior mentality that allows battering rams to be used, that allow tanks to roll through the streets of Missouri. I watched a military exercise in Palestine where Israeli troops were using battering rams against Palestinian enclaves, And that's the same sort of mentality that we have in law enforcement across the country. It is that hammer nail mentality that led to officers in Memphis brutalizing Tyre Nichols. When you think about it, Mike, there are 7 or 8 times more Caucasian Americans traveling the streets of America every day than African Americans. So logically, there are 7 or 8 times more occasions when young white kids are driving either on a suspended license or with a taillight that is out or with something going on that leads to a traffic interaction. But Jim, Mike, never do you see an occasion of an unarmed white kid being brutalized or dying in police custody. That, my friends, is a function of this cultural problem that is so endemic to law enforcement across the country. I dare say, if there was a white unarmed kid who died in police custody following a routine traffic stop, that would become international news.
Carl, do you think that in the future, where high-profile killings by white police officers are involved, we may see evidence of these assaults being more quickly released and, where appropriate, white cops prosecuted more quickly as well?
Regrettably, Mike, the police union has been conspicuously silent in this instance of these black police officers in Memphis. I've heard no outcry about how dare they prosecute them for voluntary manslaughter. I've heard no outcry to how dare they fire them so quickly rather than suspend them while the administrative process works its way. I've heard no outcry that the videos never show the full story and you should give a chance for the full story to be heard and released. Through the prism of my experience, I can't help but believe that race has some impact. The prevalence of body cameras, however, I think, has been a revolutionary advantage so that all of America can see what many in my field have claimed have been going on for decades. I always tell my staff and my clients, change turns at the speed of an ocean liner, not a speedboat. I wish it were different, Mike, but change, real change, turns at the speed of an ocean liner. So regrettably, the names of Kenan Anderson are going to fade through most of our memories. Regrettably, the name of Tyre Nichols is going to fade, and there will be another circumstance and another hashtag. And hopefully, with these repeated visual instances, hopefully the tide of change will continue moving and there will be a more equitable and fair treatment of all of our communities by law enforcement officers who are supposed to protect and serve us all.
Well, let me follow up on that if I can, Carl. Then that's a wonderful point. Last year, 2022, there were in fact more police killings in America than in any previous year. But going forward with this idea of the slow but hopefully some progress being made, some critics of police violence are saying that the fact that the cops, as well as the victim in the Tyre Nichols case, were black, may speed up the way in which that ocean liner, if you will, takes its turn in these cases. That is, force society to look more closely at the mentality of cops, at the mentality of policing that produces so much unlawful and violent policing. There's some optimism saying that, well, perhaps it'll force the government to change the way police are trained. support calls, if not to defund the police, at least give them less money and less restrict their activities. Why should they be sent out on minor traffic accidents and the like? What about qualified immunity? I know folks like yourself have been calling for the elimination of qualified immunity, and explain that for our listeners, that legally protects the police who kill. So given this sorry story so far, and the fact that I think you're quite right, it's an ocean liner of turning out a speedboat, how much confidence do you have that we might see some actual progress here? And where are the areas of progress you think we ought to concentrate most clearly?
Well, Jim, I am always optimistic. That is my nature. That is what keeps me going every day of my life. So optimism is my way. I remind your listeners of a white guy from Buffalo, New York, named Martin Gugino, G-U-G-I-N-O. Mr. Gugino was protesting the George Floyd protests, and stormtrooper types knocked him backwards in a very public display, and you could see blood coming out of his ears. Mr. Gugino now suffers from traumatic brain injury from that incident. But that image is what is going to have to be necessary, regrettably, before real change will be affected. So until there is a connection visually where the object of the police action looks like the normal white American, his brother, his sister, his mother, or his dad, that will overcome the coded messages that many in our political world are using now. Code words like wokeism and this railing against wokeism. The belief that the thin blue line is the last bastion of protection between the urban core and the suburban outlets. That fear is what allows police officers to continue to maintain their influence in this nation of ours. And given the current makeup of our congressional legislature, I have little optimism that there's going to be any real change, certainly not in the next 2 years. It's important to remember, though, even in Minneapolis, the images of Black Lives Matter are worse in 2023 than they were before the day George Floyd died. The impact of the numbers of police killings, I say, are partially a function of this nation coming out of 2 years of isolation. That affects everyone, I believe. Those that have been shot and those trained killers that are doing the shooting. So is there really any wonder that there are the highest number of officer-involved deaths in many years after coming out of 2 years of isolation, anxiety, and depression from this national nightmare of the pandemic?
Explain what qualified immunity is and the pernicious role that it plays in protecting the police who kill.
Sure, Jim. Qualified immunity is a federally created standard that police officers can use to say that unless the wrongfulness of their actions were clearly established at that time, then they are shielded from responsibility for their actions. It's a concept that provides another layer of protection for police officers. Mike, Jim, I've been suing cops now for 37 of my 43 years as a lawyer, and I tend to stay out of federal courts here in California because we have a really robust state civil rights statute that doesn't have qualified immunity. And I'm so afraid that some conservative federal judges will use that as an excuse to prevent worthy plaintiffs from seeking justice in the federal courts. So I stay out of federal courts whenever I can.
We're speaking with Attorney Carl Douglas. I'm Michael Smith. I'm with my former law partner, Attorney Jim Lafferty. We're here on Law and Disorder. Carl is one of the preeminent police abuse attorneys in Los Angeles. Carl, we know that the police played a key role in capturing and returning black slaves in the early days of policing in America. Indeed, slaves were, after all, nothing more than property to return to their rightful owners. We know how important slavery was to the economy of the South, and in fact in the North, in both the pre and post days of slavery in America. Do you agree with those critics of policing in America who argue that the police are here primarily to protect and serve the 1%, and that very few black people are members of that elite club?
When you understand, Mike, the historical perspective of law enforcement as you have ably described it, how can you not but be questioned the overall usefulness of any structural system that was born out of that predicate? I understand and I accept that societies, ordered societies, must have some way to remove those who sacrificed the privilege of living among us. But at the same time, the abuses that law enforcement officers have wielded on black, brown, and marginalized communities, the structural nature of racism born from the vestiges of slavery, as you have described, just creates a greater challenge for fair-minded people when they consider why members of certain communities lack the trust in our law enforcement that is enjoyed in other portions of our communities. And it is going to be a continual struggle for reasonable treatment and for equality. And the struggle continues. But I have to maintain optimism. I have to maintain hope. Otherwise, I would be unable to get out of my bed in the morning, fellas.
Carl, one piece of good news. Memphis has now quickly shut down, at least for now, its Scorpion unit. These units and others like it all over America patrol neighborhoods, pretty much occupy neighborhoods, engage in a lot of unnecessary stop and frisking of drivers and the like, and more often than not lead to the kinds of unlawful policing and violence of the citizens that we've seen here. Might such special police units in other cities now come under more scrutiny as well? Is that a optimistic sign that maybe we can expect to see some of these other invasive units shut down in communities of America? And also, what other reforms quickly can you recommend that you would hope might be now given more attention than they have been up till now?
Well, Jim, there certainly has, reflected in the Memphis experience, been a problem highlighted with these specialized units. It's important to remember that this unit was brought to Memphis from the police chief who came there from Atlanta. So she certainly saw the wisdom of disbanding them. These units have had issues across this country. The Rampart scandal was conducted by officers that were in the crash unit, community response against street hoodlums. They were in an isolated trailer by themselves. They worked unusual hours. They spent all of their time together, isolated and insulated. And it led invariably to this culture, this subculture, the gang-like culture that we see often in parts of the sheriff's department here in Los Angeles. So it is indeed a circumstance that is ripe for problems and abuse. That is indeed a problem. What can we hope in the future is the continual infusion of young minds into policing. I hope that will add to greater enlightenment. I hope the greater use of body-worn cameras in law enforcement across the country, the sheriff's department here in Los Angeles just got them within the last year. That is going to lead to a better environment. And as important, swifter accountability for law enforcement officers by district attorneys across our country is the best way to generate reform. Swift justice is what was missing in Memphis, and which enabled those officers to joke about rocking him and complaining about their leg hurting from kicking a guy in the knee and in the face. Or you saw the guy's asp did not return to its normal shape because it had been bent when he cracked it against the guy's head. So I think a greater infusion of younger minds, the retiring of the old guard, in time will lead to a better culture that is more guardian in spirit and in actions.
Carl Douglas, I hope you're right. I share some of that optimism. Let's hope. We'll see. We'll keep following this story. In the meanwhile, we thank you so much for your legal work on the issues we've been discussing today, and we thank you so much for joining us here on Law and Disorder Radio.
Gentlemen, thank you so much for having me, and please have me come back again. This is a very important program talking about very important issues of concern.
Thank you. We'd like to get you back when you announce your victory in the Anderson case. You take it easy, Carl.
Okay, guys, stay well. Take care.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
We speak today with New York City Attorney Deb Herbeck, who, along with her law partner, Margaret Ratner Kunstler, are suing the CIA, its former director, Mike Pompeo, and the company they contracted with to spy for them on Julian Assange and his visitors, including attorneys at the Ecuadorian embassy in London. Assange lived there for 7 years, having been granted political asylum by the Ecuadorian government. The CIA contract employee, DC Global, copied information off of their cell phones and computers when they visited their client, Julian Assange, at the embassy. They are demanding an injunction forbidding the CIA to use the private information they stole from these devices. The CIA says that it has every right to do what it did because the plaintiffs had no right to expect privacy. Julian Assange is the greatest journalist of our time. His exposures of American war crimes, corruption in the Hillary Clinton presidential campaign, and CIA spying on us using our cell phones and smart TVs was the most embarrassing revelations ever revealed about the American war machine and its diplomatic corps. In retaliation, the U.S. establishment and its institutions, including both political parties, took their revenge on Julian by first smearing him, according to a Defense Department directive, and then threatening him and charging him as a spy under the Espionage Act, so that he had to take refuge in the Ecuadorian embassy in London. Then Trump indicted him for espionage and had their British collaborators drag him out of the Ecuadorian embassy and put him in London's Belmarsh prison, a notorious maximum security prison, where he's been tortured daily for the last 3 years by being held in solitary confinement and denied adequate medical care. The USA and its servant, the British Crown Prosecutorial Service, trashed the rule of law throughout the entire extradition proceedings. They lied about the conditions of confinement that Julian would face in the United States. The judge changed her mind after she ruled in Julian's favor, and now the extradition order is imminent. We speak today with Deborah Herbeck, who is a founding partner of the Herbeck Kunstler Law Firm, an entertainment firm that has represented WikiLeaks in media law matters since 2015. In the course of her work with WikiLeaks journalists and filmmakers, she has visited Julian Assange many times, both in the Ecuadorian embassy in London, where he was held as a political asylee, and in recent years in Belmarsh prison. Herbeck is one of the plaintiffs in the Kunstler versus CIA lawsuit, an action that seeks to hold the U.S. government accountable for its illegal activities in connection with the prosecution of Julian Assange. Attorney Deborah Herbeck, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Please tell us about yourself and how and why you got involved in the defense of Julian Assange.
Well, I'm a media lawyer based in Manhattan, and a good friend of mine who's since turned a good friend of the show, Michael Ratner, was representing Julian Assange. And at the time, Julian Assange was in the Ecuadorian embassy in London, where Michael Ratner had negotiated for him to get asylum there. And there were a number of media projects that Julian was invited to participate in particular, a German and Danish television crew was making a film called Snowden's Flight. It was just after Snowden had gone to Russia, and they wanted to use some footage of Julian in the show for TV, and Michael invited me in to represent Julian in that negotiation. And since then, I've been helping Julian individually in WikiLeaks as an organization, and Sunshine Press as an organization, which is a film arm of WikiLeaks, and a number of the individual journalists and videographers at WikiLeaks with their various media projects.
Deb, on the occasion of one of your and your partner Margaret Ratner-Kussler's visits with Julian Assange when he was at the Ecuadorian embassy where he had taken political asylum with their permission, you both felt that the treatment you received was, well, so violative of your rights, particularly your privacy rights, that you then later both filed a lawsuit over that treatment. I wonder, would you please describe the treatment that so enraged you that some people engaged in? Who were those folks, and what was the full nature of that treatment?
Happy to, Jim. The treatment at the time that we endured was not so clearly violative. At the time that we went to visit Julian at the embassy, there was security staff there that we assumed were personnel from the Ecuadorian government who were there to protect Julian. Remember, at the time, this was a place where Julian was seeking sanctuary, and this was a friendly government who had taken him in. So when we went to the embassy, there was a protocol where you would surrender your passport, and if you brought it in with you, your cell phone and any other electronics at the desk, and at the front desk, the security desk, and they were held, we thought, for safekeeping while we met with Julian. And it was partly to record who'd come in and out, and partly to make sure that we couldn't take photographs and things like that. That was the protocol for every single visitor. And we did not actually at the time consider it to be a violation at all. It seemed just sensible safety procedure. It was only much, much later, after Julian had been removed from the embassy and dragged to custody at Belmarsh Prison, where he still is now almost 4 years later, that it became apparent, based on reporting from essentially whistleblowers from the security staff at the embassy, that they had been tasked not with just taking our belongings for safekeeping, but with actually opening up the cell phones, copying the cell phones, in some cases downloading the information from our materials. The personnel were not, in fact, Ecuadorian government staff. They were, in fact, private security personnel. It was a Spanish security company, UC Global, that had been engaged by the Ecuadorian government to perform the security tasks at the embassy. And unbeknownst to anyone at the embassy, in terms of visitors or WikiLeaks personnel or Julian, the CIA had turned David Morales, who was the CEO of UC Global at the time, and basically turned him into an agent sometime in early 2017. And from that time onwards, essentially the security personnel were agents of the U.S. government, agents of the CIA, who were in fact taking our materials and recording our conversations with our client. And that was when that became apparent, which wasn't until late 2019, that's when we, in retrospect, realized how appallingly we had been treated and how violative that was of our rights. Because as U.S. Citizens, we have the right to be free of unreasonable search and seizures by our government under the U.S. Constitution, whether we're on U.S. soil or not.
Attorney Deborah Beck, your lawsuit states that you've suffered and continue to suffer irreparable harm, including having and continuing to have your privacy violated, your personal files and privileged communications with your clients unlawfully seized and copied, and now permanently possessed by the CIA. What relief are you demanding?
Well, essentially what we're asking for is that since the materials that we had on our computers and phones and the substance of the recordings with Julian and other personnel in the embassy should not have landed in the hands of the U.S. government, we're asking that for an injunction that would require the government to purge its files of all such materials and to prevent the government from using those materials in any way, shape, or form against Julian or against any other person or in any other investigative activity that they may be undertaking. I mean, by way of example, Nancy Hollander, who represents a number of Guantanamo Bay detainees, was somebody who was visiting Julian on a fairly regular basis, and she had active cases against the U.S. government for her Guantanamo Bay clients on her phone or laptop if she took it in, etc. So our concerns go way beyond our own personal sense of violation. Our concerns are that the U.S. government doesn't use the material seized by us and others similarly situated in a manner that is inappropriate and unlawful.
You know, the United States government, Deb, as you know better than most, has engaged in numerous violations of law in the Julian Assange case, some truly egregious, of course. For starters, we know that 11 years ago, the government issued a paper to media and everybody else trying to smear Julian Assange. It contained all sorts of lies about Julian in an effort to diminish the influence of his exposure, well, of U.S. war crimes in Iraq and Afghanistan. We know, too, that even more shocking, really, as a result of Yahoo's release of recordings and transcripts, we now know that then-President Donald Trump and then-CIA Director Mike Pompeo actually discussed how to have Assange murdered. Your thoughts on these campaigns of the government to silence Assange one way or another and the impact they may have had on his case?
Well, it's actually been really shocking. I mean, essentially, the United States government weaponized information. They essentially launched a full-fledged Dirty Tricks character assassination campaign against Julian Assange. If you think back to 11 years ago, Julian was becoming a bit of a rock star. He was somebody who, on the left in particular, progressives admired for exposing the war crimes that the U.S. government, the U.K. government, and other Western powers had been propagating in our name and bringing to the public's attention war crimes in a way that would turn the public against these wars we were engaging in a similar way to what was done in the 60s and 70s with the Vietnam War. And this was something that was very threatening to the government, and they needed to put a stop to it. And one of the ways that they did that was by making the figurehead of WikiLeaks, Julian Assange was the editor-in-chief at the time and the public face of WikiLeaks, demonizing him, making him into a pariah, and thereby undermining the credibility of the materials he was releasing. They couldn't attack the materials. The materials had been verified. Indeed, they were amplified by the traditional press, so clearly journalists, they withstood scrutiny of traditional journalists, so they couldn't attack substantively what WikiLeaks was doing in terms of releasing the Afghan war logs and collateral murder videos that exposed these atrocious behaviors of our government. So all they could do was shoot the messenger, and that's pretty much what they've been doing ever since.
This is Attorney Michael Smith. I'm here with my co-host, Attorney Jim Lafferty. We're speaking with Attorney Deborah Beck, who's right now in the process of suing the CIA. Deb, Assange's extradition hearing in London was a farce, wasn't it? For starters, Julian was not even able to fully participate in the hearing. And after a favorable initial ruling by the judge to the effect that if Julian Assange were to be returned to the United States, he would be imprisoned under such torturous prison conditions that given his already impaired mental state, he could not survive mentally, and that in fact he might even commit suicide. But the United States appealed that favorable finding by offering a non-binding assurance to the court that he could be imprisoned under more favorable circumstances. Your thoughts on this and other very troubling aspects of the extradition hearing itself?
Well, one of the most difficult issues in trying to analyze what's really going on in the extradition hearing process, so much of what's going on is going on outside the courtroom. So, yes, it's true there were some due process issues with the proceedings in London. Honestly, as somebody who used to practice criminal defense, there's very rarely a court proceeding where a defendant feels fairly treated. So I don't know that the way that the trial was conducted was, in truth, any worse or better than any other criminal defendant or somebody in that position would be treated. What's interesting here is that even though there's this process of the extradition proceeding, the real trial is in the public arena. The real trial is political. The U.S. government supposedly wants to extradite him, and yet he's not here. The judge, while the initial judge, the magistrate judge, who initially ruled in Julian's favor and denied the U.S. government's extradition request, did so on the very narrow basis that she found that he was a suicide risk. It was a very surprising ruling, and it came at the very end of a very long, detailed, very political statement by the judge that she roundly rejected all of the substantive arguments that Julian had against extradition. I mean, one of the main bases for being able to defend yourself against an extradition in any country, but in particular in the UK, which is what's relevant here, is if it's a political offense. If there's a, if you feel you're being politically persecuted and there's something, some evidence to indicate that might be the case. Now, you don't get much more political than a situation like this, where you have from President Obama to Hillary Clinton to Donald Trump and now to Joe Biden, people declaring WikiLeaks is a danger to the Western world. So then on top of everything else, the facts that have been, that were initially reported in Yahoo News in at the end of 2019, that there was, at the end of 2021, that there was in fact a concerted CIA campaign to kidnap or even assassinate Assange when he was in the embassy. So this is, it's quite clear that there was this vendetta against Assange perpetrated by the U.S. government. And that being the case, it's actually quite astonishing that on the face of it, that the court system hasn't just extradited him, because supposedly that's what we want. But so it seems that that's probably not what the government wants. The government doesn't really want him to get extradited and come back to the United States, where the principles of free press would be put even more on the line than they are already, where the Fourth Estate would rally around him, presumably, just to be able to make sure we don't have a precedent set that's terrible. What they want is for him to rot in jail, and that's what's happening, and that's what's so incredibly tragic about this whole case. It's big and yet it's small. It's big in the issues and yet it's small, and then this one man is being martyred in this horrific way. It's really, really a tragedy.
Deb, I still thank you for raising that legal objection to the use of the Extradition Act between the U.S. and England anyway. And in addition to whether or not it's political, and if it is, that bars the extradition, as you've pointed out, and it clearly is political, it's also the case that under our treaty, extradition treaty with Britain, no one is to be extradited if torture has been involved. And the UN Rapporteur on Torture, and well, you can talk to us about that. I mean, it's so clear that Julian himself has been subjected to torture in the way he's been held and what have you, which would be another reason not to honor the act and not to extradite him. But I do think your point about the political or underlying political cause behind it, what I hear you saying, tell me if I'm wrong, does is that England, as a friend and partner of the United States, is simply cooperating with the United States' desire not to have him here and embarrass the government here because of it going after freedom of the press, but rather to allow him to die under these torturous conditions and under his health conditions in England so as not to have to deal with that.
Jim, I think that's spot on. That's exactly right. And then on a broader level, it has a chilling effect. It's deterring other brave journalists and publications from doing the same thing as WikiLeaks and Julian did, because they, you know, people are concerned about finding themselves in the same situation. It's human nature.
During the Vietnam War, the famous whistleblower Daniel Ellsberg released the Pentagon Papers, which revealed government secrets, just like those revealed by Julian Assange. But because of what the judge in Ellsberg's case called severe governmental misconduct, including when the government raided the offices of Ellsberg's psychiatrist, the case was against Ellsberg was thrown out of court. The case against him was for violating the Espionage Act, and that was thrown out of court. And Julian Assange is also accused of violating the Espionage Act. He's facing 175 years in prison for violating it. Do you think his case should also be thrown out of court for governmental misconduct?
Absolutely. If ever a case called for it, this does. I think that the strongest evidence is the evidence uncovered by Michael Isikoff, the journalist who was one of the lead reporters on the Yahoo News case that exposed the CIA goal to kidnap and assassinate Julian Assange. On top of that, we have footage of or audio of Hillary Clinton wanting to drone him. Not just the Ellsberg case. I mean, my law partner Margaret Kunstler, her husband Bill Kunstler represented the people at Wounded Knee, and that similarly, there was a government misconduct situation that assisted in that case. This is why we supposedly live in a country where we have due process. When the government doesn't use due process and when they persecute somebody, no matter what their goals are, good or bad, that is a very sound defense to any crime, let alone a crime under the Espionage Act.
Deb, following up with respect to this Espionage Act, World War I Espionage Act, I believe Julian Assange is the first journalist to have ever been indicted under that act. And the great public intellectual Noam Chomsky, who was one of the chairs of the National Assange Defense Committee, has stated that the act itself should be repealed. What is the argument for repealing the Espionage Act and certainly as well for not using it in this case?
Well, the strongest argument for repealing the Espionage Act is the fact that it's so widely misused. It's essentially, it was created in 1917, over 100 years ago, to deal with, this was during the First World War, to deal with seditious conspiracies, to deal with overthrowing governments, to deal with spying that was of a level that was of great danger to our nation. Even if you take what Julian Assange and WikiLeaks are accused of having done here, we're talking about exposing actual, verifiable, true crimes that the government of the United States committed. This is not a danger to the United States to expose government crimes. It's the opposite. That is in the furtherance of democracy, that people should know who they're voting for, that the U.S. public has a right to know what the government is doing in its name before its tax dollars are spent continuing with this warfare. So the idea that the Espionage Act, which was created to protect the United States as a body, is being used to attack people who are trying to preserve democracy by promoting transparency is an abomination. And to the extent that the language of the act is such that it could be used in this way, in that it's even arguable that these charges could stand against a journalist, is in and of itself demonstrates the fact that it needs to be repealed or drastically revised.
Deborah Beck, according to Ben Wisner, the director of the ACLU's Speech Privacy and Technology Project, the prosecution of Julian Assange represents the first time in the history of our country that the government has brought criminal charges against a publisher for the publication of truthful information. And Julian Assange is not even a U.S. citizen. If Julian is tried and convicted, how will this impact journalists and broadcasters like ourselves?
Well, the issue we have here is really the selective prosecution, apart from anything else. Some people say that it won't affect U.S. journalists because Julian's not a journalist and WikiLeaks is not a publication. None of that really matters. The point is that there's a chilling effect from the mere fact that publishing truthful information, which was what most people had learned in journalism school was the whole point of the exercise, could be criminalized. And just that fact, on a domestic level, stops people from doing their jobs if the people that they're reporting about is the government. And remember, the press in this, because the reason why the First Amendment contains the right to free speech and freedom of the press is because that is the most important protection that a democracy has against an overreaching government. Transparency is key to a real democracy. So our whole fundamental being as a nation is challenged by this. But even leaving that aside, when you're taking U.S. laws and trying to enforce them against a foreign journalist, if this becomes acceptable, think about if China decides that a U.S. journalist who criticizes the Chinese government should be extradited to China because that journalist breached Chinese laws or the equivalent of the Chinese Espionage Act. How absurd is that? That an Australian citizen located outside of the United States when this reporting took place is supposedly falls within the jurisdiction for us as the United States to bring here to punish under our domestic laws. We wouldn't put up with that if any other country in the world were trying to do this against an American journalist, or at least I hope we wouldn't.
No, that's a good point. And also, isn't it the case that whatever may have been true at the outset when the government was spreading lies about Julian and all the rest they were doing, including try to talk about how they could actually murder him, despite all of that, this case has caught the attention of the world now, has it not? You've got the leading newspapers of the world issuing statements about how he should not be prosecuted, including newspapers in American newspapers. You've got the major organizations of journalists throughout the world calling to drop the charges against Julian Assange. Every human rights group you can name and others I'd never heard of until I read about them have condemned the persecution and prosecution of Julian Assange. This has really caught on now, and I think underlines what you were saying before about the fear of the United States being embarrassed if he comes back here. But talk to us about just how widespread now the movement to free Julian is.
Well, there has been a noticeable shift in the last couple of years, which those of us who have been watching and supportive of WikiLeaks and Julian have been quite pleased to see. It's late in the game, but it's certainly needed. Very late in the game. The publications such as the New York Times and the Washington Post and the Guardian and Der Spiegel, the publications that amplified the information that was released by WikiLeaks that shocked the world about the nature and depth of the U.S. and U.K. war crimes, have finally joined free speech advocates who have been bringing to the attention of the public the fact that this is an outrageous precedent to be set, whatever you might think of Julian as an individual, which you only think that because of what you've read in the papers, but whatever you may think of about Julian or the organization or its aims, which it's a fundamentally anti-war transparency organization, but whatever you may think that WikiLeaks is that you may disapprove of, you have to accept that danger set by weaponizing the Espionage Act in this way is extremely dangerous for the free press in this country. And then even beyond, the Australian Prime Minister has sort of leaked, I think, that is the best way of putting it, but rumor has it that the Australian Prime Minister has been advocating on behalf of Julian basically saying enough is enough and asking Biden to drop the extradition. A number of South and Central American leaders have spoken out in their support of WikiLeaks and of Julian Assange. So the hope is that we'll see a shift. We've seen nothing from Biden or from the Merrick Garland, and we don't know why that is, but hopefully the pressure is mounting, and we'll see him out sometime soon.
Now that the Biden administration has fully embraced the indictment handed down by Trump and actively is seeking to extradite Julian, what can people do to help, and how can people be in touch with you and your lawsuit and learn more about your work?
Well, the best resource for staying on top of what's going on with this case is AssangeDefense.org. The Assange Defense Campaign is based in New York, and it has members across the country, including Jim Lafferty and myself, and I believe Michael Smith. And we meet regularly to help coordinate the activism that's going on around the country. Nathan Fuller, who's in charge of all of the activities in the United States in support of Julian Assange and WikiLeaks, keeps the website up to date. So AssangeDefense.org is the place to go. In terms of our lawsuit, we're keeping the website updated with that information. We're calling press conferences when appropriate and blasting the latest developments. I mean, the real point of our lawsuit is to help bring attention to the depths to which this government's going in order to get Assange. They would go so low as to record privileged conversations between Julian and his lawyers, privileged conversations between Julian and his doctors, privileged conversations between a source and journalists, national security journalists, and just cast aside any pretense of constitutional safeguards that we have in place to protect us. So that's just one in a number of advocacy and activist activities going on that we would love for people to pay attention to and get engaged in.
We very much admire what you're doing. Thank you so much for being on Law and Disorder, and we expect that you'll come back on when there are more updates in this really important case, this case done in the tradition of Michael Ratner. Deborah Beck, thanks again for being on Law and Disorder.
Thank you for having me and for paying attention.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.